second case of the day, Eco Manufacturing versus Honeywell. Joanda?
May it please the court. My name is Chris Landau, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellant Honeywell. The district court in this case committed a core legal error that permeates its entire analysis. It started from the premise that a utility patent reflects a bargain between the patent owner and the public to give intellectual property rights for a limited period of time, after which the public has the right to copy the invention. Under this view, patent law and trademark law are mutually exclusive. There's a fork in the road. Once you go down the trademark path, or the patent path, excuse me, you can't later go down the trademark path. Indeed, the district court painted Honeywell as the bad guy for claiming and defending trademark rights in its round thermostat design, given the court's premise that such rights would improperly extend the scope of its utility patent. That core premise, as I'll get to in a moment, is squarely inconsistent with settled law from both this court and the Supreme Court. But before getting to the district court's legal errors, I'd like to just take a step back and underscore the truly extraordinary posture of this case. The district court expressly found that the Honeywell round had achieved strong secondary meaning and that customers would likely be confused by the introduction of Echo's inferior knockoff thermostat, which is conceitedly a copy of Honeywell's round design. Nonetheless, the court proceeded to invalidate the Honeywell mark as functional, even though that mark is not only federally registered, but indeed incontestable, and has long been the company's icon and the crown jewel of its trademark portfolio. And all this, it's worth emphasizing, at the preliminary injunction phase, based on the legal premise, again, that Honeywell is trying to renege on its patent bargain. We're not aware of any case, and Echo hasn't cited any, where a district court has invalidated an incontestable mark at the preliminary injunction stage, much less where, as here, the district court...
Counsel, I'm not sure what you mean when you say has invalidated. My understanding of what's happened is that the district court has said that Honeywell is not entitled to a preliminary injunction, but that a trial lies ahead for the purpose of determining whether Honeywell might be entitled to relief at the permanent injunction stage.
You're right, Your Honor.
If you say invalidated, you're implying that the case is over, which is not what I understand.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. I should have said refuse to enforce, and which is...
Well, it's held that Honeywell is, on this record, not entitled to preliminary injunctive relief.
That's fair, Your Honor. I'm sorry. You're absolutely right in terms of the language. But
just to make sure I understand it, if I'm understanding it correct, your adversary is at this moment not only entitled to produce its version of this thermostat, but is of course at risk of damages if Honeywell wins in the end. There's no immunity blanket being thrown over its conduct.
That's true, Your Honor. Although this court has recognized that selling an infringing product would give rise to irreparable injury. Indeed, this kind of case is
It may give rise to an injunction, but you don't want to say it's irreparable in the sense that it would be impossible for the district court to compute damages, because I'm quite confident you'll be telling the district judge exactly what your damages are.
Your Honor, I think that's a fair point, but certainly if you look at preliminary injunction cases, I think trademarks are perhaps the classic example of where preliminary injunctions tend to be appropriate. In other words, we come into court seeking a preliminary injunction, I think, under very different circumstances and very different settings than just the average litigant. We come in with a federally registered and indeed incontestable mark.
Almost every plaintiff believes that it has a case above average.
No, Your Honor, that is absolutely fair. So you know, but certainly I think this court has recognized over time that protection of trademark rights, given the injury that they produce, is pretty much the paradigmatic example for preliminary injunctive relief. And again, that's what we're seeking here. We come in with a federally registered mark, an incontestable mark, and we're just seeking relief pending a trial on the merits. We may lose at a trial on the merits. We don't think we will.
You say every mark that is challenged is entitled to preliminary injunctions.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I apologize if I suggested that. Certainly, you have to look at the likelihood of success on the merits, and you
right.
can't come in with a bogus claim. But we think certainly coming in with a registered and incontestable mark is different than the average case. Let's say where somebody comes in with unregistered trade dress, the burdens are very different, Your Honor. I think that the point is, though, in terms of the other factors, in particular irreparable injury, those kind of factors are presumed in the trademark context, where they are often a real uphill battle in your run-of-the-mill plain vanilla case.
Yeah, but just in this context, isn't it easier to measure how much business Echo got than how much they didn't get?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that that would be the appropriate measure of our damages, in the sense that I think the problem from a preliminary injunction point of view with irreparable injury is that it's so hard to measure the damage that our mark would suffer by the introduction of a cheap knockoff. That, in other words, I'm not sure that Echo's, whatever Echo made by selling its knockoff, would be an appropriate reflection of our damages, because it seems to me there's not only the lost sales, let's say, but I think there's also a degradation in our brand.
Well, that second part is different. Obviously, the lost sales would have to be measured by whatever Echo got. But once if you win and Echo is stopped, there's not going to be any more knockoffs, as far as they're concerned.
That's right. I mean, that's right. If we win and they're stopped, that will be the end of it.
The diminution in whatever reputation that somebody that bought one of the knockoffs thinks Honeywell does the same thing.
Right, Your Honor, but I think it's important to step back and see, again, what are the basic presumptions that you come into court with? Again, we have here the registered mark. We've played by the rules in that sense. We've gotten this registered, it's become incontestable.
It's actually quite unclear whether you played by the rules. The district judge believed you deceived the PTO.
Well, Your Honor, the district judge did not. He went down that path. I think, as I said in my opening, Your Honor, that the district judge started from the premise that we were trying to pull a fast one in this whole thing. That he just, I think if you look at what's the core theme that really runs through his opinion, is that somehow this just isn't right what Honeywell's doing. And he depicts Honeywell as being very heavy-handed in terms of exercising its trademark rights.
Heavy-handedness differs from deceit. The district judge found, I think it's probably correct to say, found as a fact that Honeywell had deceived the PTO. Now, it's perfectly fine, so far as I'm concerned, for Honeywell to be very aggressive in exercising its legal rights, but there are problems in ex parte proceedings of trying to pull a fast one on a government agency. And you have a serious burden here at the preliminary injunction stage, where our review is particularly deferential in dealing with a finding such as that.
But I think, Your Honor, specifically to address your point, the district court did not find that we deceived the PTO. I mean, that he specifically said he did not find the necessary intent at the PI stage. This would be a very different case, Your Honor, if the district court had held that Honeywell had committed fraud and that on the PTO, and therefore our registration was invalid. This case would come to you on a record that we would have had that knocked out.
No, I guess I'm going to stop doing this. The district judge didn't find anything valid or invalid. Didn't find the PTO valid or invalid. Didn't find the mark valid or invalid. We're at the preliminary injunctions.
You're right.
We're arguing probabilities, not whether something is valid. And
there.
So to say the district judge didn't find finally that there had been X doesn't mean that we now ignore it.
No, Your Honor, but he didn't even find preliminarily that there was likely fraud on the PTO. He specifically, Your Honor, and expressly stopped short of that. And so this case was decided by the district court below. As this case comes to this court, the district court has left intact the incontestable registration. And the question that's presented to this court is the functionality determination. Did the district court err as a matter of law in declaring that, again, you're absolutely right, Your Honor, that this is just a question of his prediction, it's not set in stone, but that the mark which the district court did not, at the preliminary stage, declare was likely to be obtained by fraud or was likely invalid because of fraud was functional. It's functionality that's the core issue here, Your Honor. And it's that issue, with all respect, that I'd like to try and focus on this morning. And the district court, in our view, as we set forth in our briefs, made two fundamental errors on functionality. First, in our view, as a legal matter, the district court erred by allowing ECHO to raise a functionality challenge at all, because the 1998 statute, which added functionality as a basis for challenging an incontestable mark, does not say anything about its retroactive effect to marks that had already become incontestable.
How is it retroactive to apply the legislation to events that happen after the legislation's enactment?
Because, Your Honor, I think the presumption against retroactivity starts with the premise that new statutes are enacted, those statutes have effective dates. For instance, the statute in Lanham.
The effective date deals with events before and events after. Right? In Landgraf, when the Supreme Court is concerned with the effect of the 1991 Civil Rights Act,
right,
it draws the line as behavior that took place after the enactment of the Act.
Correct, Your Honor.
The behavior in question here is the sale of this supposedly infringing thermostat, all of which happened after the effective date of the Act. So I don't see in what sense it's retroactive.
Well, Your Honor, retroactivity, I think, as the Court made clear, particularly in the Schumer, Hughes Aircraft Company versus Schumer case, does not only look to the actual primary conduct. That is one thing that it looks at, but it also looks to the unsettling of expectations. When we obtained incontestable status, Honeywell obtained incontestable status in 1996 for something called an incontestable mark. That is a very valuable right, as the Supreme Court emphasized in Parkinfly and this Court emphasized in Union Carbide. There were certain sticks that came in that bundle.
So is it your argument that an incontestable mark carries with it forever, until the end of the world, whatever rights and privileges it carried when it became incontestable?
No, Your Honor.
Even if somebody who gets a new incontestable mark today has fewer or different rights?
No, Your Honor, that's not our position. Our position is that Congress can do that.
Then I don't get it.
Okay. Your Honor, there's a difference here between congressional power. Congress can make an incontestable mark worth less by amending the statute. The question is purely one of congressional intent. We take the 98 statute. Do we deem Congress to have, without saying anything about the effect on marks that had already become incontestable, which are substantial? I mean, again, the incontestability right is essentially a quiet title right. The question is, when Congress obviously had reasons for enacting the 98 statute and thinking we're going to add a new defense to incontestability. Fine, Congress is certainly entitled to do that. Congress is entitled, if it wants to, subject only to due process limitations, to make that retroactive, to make existing incontestable marks less valuable. The question is, did Congress do that by simply saying in the statute, this amendment shall apply only to any action filed after October 31st? It's purely a question of intent, Your Honor, not power. And so I guess the question is, people who got an incontestable mark, it meant something at the time. Pre-98, it could only be challenged.
If you're not arguing power, then I don't understand why your brief is phrased in terms of vested rights. Because that's an old phrase for dealing with rights that were protected against legislative change. When you make an argument that says these are vested rights, you're making an argument about the extent of legislative power. And that's the argument that appears in your brief,
Your Honor,
which I understand that you have just abandoned.
Well, Your Honor, I think putting all our eggs in the vested rights basket, I mean, as the Supreme Court, I think, emphasized in the Hughes Aircraft versus Schumer case, it's very hard to pin down exactly the kind of things that have a retroactive effect. I mean, it applies to things such as the right not to be prosecuted after a statute of limitations has run. That's hard to emphasize, that's hard to depict as a property right or a vested right. I mean, sometimes these things get very metaphysical, and certainly, Your Honor, I wonder
why modern courts tend not to use that phrase.
Well, I think that's the first point. I apologize, Your Honor.
It's a 19th century phrase. Richard Epstein would be happy with you for using it, but it has
I certainly, to the extent that our brief suggested that we thought that it had to rise to the level of a vested right in order to have a retroactive effect, let me make it clear here at the podium today that we have a broader view of what can have a retroactive effect. And certainly, I think, you know, we don't even have to necessarily decide, it seems to me, whether or not these kind of rights would be considered property rights. Again, I think that the retroactivity issue is a much more flexible inquiry, and they certainly, I think the one point that's important to keep in mind is that they are valuable rights. I mean, I think the whole point of Park and Fly is that this is basically a right to quiet title. It's basically like a right not to have your incontestable mark challenged on certain, except on these certain enumerated grounds. Again, as this court emphasized in Union Carbide, our only point is that if Congress wants to make that a weaker right, what it needs to do is just make it clear that that's what it's doing. If I could turn from the retroactivity question, though, to the other legal question, which I think is at least as important, obviously, if we win on retroactivity, then functionality is out.
Right, so I think we should go on to functionality just in case.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We think the district court really made two errors on functionality, both with respect to utilitarian, so-called utilitarian, and aesthetic functionality. Again, I think I alluded to the district court's primary mistake, in our view, on utilitarian functionality, which is really making an estoppel out of the 1946 utility patent. And I think if there's one thing that's clear in light of this court's decision in Thomas and Betts and the Supreme Court's decision in Traffics, it's that the fork in the road approach that the district court adopted is just not correct. I mean, it's certainly a respectable view of the law. One can imagine the law having gone that way, but it didn't. The Supreme Court has made it quite clear that you can still have trademark rights even after the expiration of the patent. So the real core question here is one that the district court never addressed in its opinion, which is, does the round shape have utilitarian functionality in 2003? The district court looked at the 46 patent and said, end of story, you're a stop. And with all respect, we submitted substantial evidence below that the district court simply did not get into regarding utilitarian functionality today. In fact, we submitted the evidence testimony, which is somewhat uncomfortable, from their own president. Echo's president said that the primary function of the thermostat is to turn on and off the heating and cooling systems, and that the shape of the thermostat doesn't affect that function. And he said, you don't need a round thermostat, quote, in order to compete effectively in this business. Again, that's Echo's president saying that. And then we had substantial testimony that's summarized on page 49 of our brief from a Honeywell engineer, Stoner, again, saying that the shape of the thermostat is not essential to the purpose of the thermostat.
Let me ask you why it matters whether something is essential. That was a line some courts took, including the Sixth Circuit, but as I understand Traffics, the Supreme Court said that whether something is essential is not the definition of functionality.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court...
Maybe the district court erred in understanding the significance of patents, but your argument, bottomed on this essentiality business, seems to have problems of its own.
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court in Traffic said the Sixth Circuit had gone too far in competitive need. What they said was the Sixth Circuit had boil the inquiry and functionality down to, is it necessary to compete? And again, necessary is one of those words in the law that kind of has a spectrum of meaning from strict necessity to generally helpful. And they said the Sixth Circuit had applied too strong a standard of competitive necessity. The Supreme Court on Traffics reaffirmed part of the inquiry. And I think part of the problem is it's hard to come up with a neat and clean definition of functionality. And the Supreme Court said being essential to the purpose or use of the product is part of the functionality inquiry. It's not the be-all and end-all. I think that's in the very passage in Traffics that you're referring to, Judge Easterbrook. The court said you've got the use or purpose aspect, then you've also got competition kind of as a gloss on what it means to be essential to the use or purpose or affect the quality or cost of the article. And the Supreme Court said as a gloss on that, we've talked about competitive need, primarily in the aesthetic functionality context, and the Sixth Circuit basically put the word need on steroids and said, well, do you really need it in an absolute sense when it should be a much lower point? Our point is, regardless of how you look at it, essential to the use or even really very closely involved in the use. I mean, I think that the point remains, they're actually not making any argument in their brief, nor did they make any argument below, that the round shape really has anything functional to do today in 2003. Again, I think they are here defending a bright line rule that somehow the key question all goes back to 1946. And I think that our basic point here is that the district court erred and the other side errs by saying that the functionality in 1946 inquiry is the touchstone. What we never had below, and what we, again, we think we don't even need a hearing below on this point because the evidence is uncontroverted, there is no functionality today in 2003, and that's really the key point.
All right.
I think my time has expired.
Thanks, Mondo. Mr. Watson.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is David Laughlin. I represent the Applee Eco Manufacturing. I'd like to address a couple of points that Honeywell made in its arguments. The first one being that Honeywell says that Eco has presented no evidence regarding present-day functionality. Eco not only presented evidence of present-day functionality, but tied that type of functionality and use and purpose to the use and purposes that were set forth in the 1946 patent that issued to Honeywell, the 920 patent. The way that was done was through the testimony of Mr. Stoner. You'll find it in Honeywell's appendix in pages about 100 to 120. You'll find that he talks about the fact that he talks about his wife and the fact that she can spot something being crooked on a wall from all the way across the room. And that type of person is someone that's sensitive to alignment, visual alignment, and that's one of the things that make a thermostat attractive. It is a purpose. Honeywell makes much of the fact that the purpose of a thermostat is simply to control temperature. That's not quite the whole truth. If a perfect thermostat were made, you would never see it. It would be behind the wall, yet it would be able to sense the air condition temperatures inside a room and be able to affect control inside that room. So the perfect thermostat is completely unobtrusive. Now, what Honeywell wants to say...
In what way is that the perfect thermostat?
Because you would never...
It's so unobtrusive you won't be able to set it?
Well, you would be able to set it by some way that you can't see.
You can phone it in now today. Right?
You could phone it in. Some way you could set it like a remote
you
control.
Would set it, you would set it by telekinesis. Your mind would reach out and turn the dial behind the plaster wallboard.
Perhaps. Some infrared system behind the wall. Honeywell hadn't come up with that yet. But you would not see it, because when you see it in a room, it begins to add these problems of, is it aligned? Does it begin to upset you in that way? And when it's in the room, it also has to be safe. And Mr. Stoner testified in those same pages I talked about in the record that the greater radius of curvature is less likely to cause projecting parts and to cause injury. So Honeywell's own engineer gave evidence that the purposes that were set forth in the 920 patent are still being met by the thermostat today. I also point out that the court heard testimony regarding Honeywell advertising. And Honeywell made much of its advertising regarding, in the beginning, that no longer do you have to have the boxy shape or the coffin-like shape. And they still, in their 917 patent, which is cited in our appendix near the end of the appendix, the first column of that patent talks about that there are people that prefer thermostat shapes either rectangular or round. And they simply have a preference for one or the other. Also, that patent talks about there may be a functional relationship between the control. Whether it's a lever-mounted or a lever-controlled thermostat, it's probably rectangular. Centrally mounted dial, it's probably round. So there's still functionality past and present based on that. The district court also heard evidence regarding a replacement market. Honeywell
What was the functionality claim in the patent?
The functionality claim, there were three purposes. Claim 23 of the 920 patent claimed a round base, circular convex shape cover, and a concentrically mounted adjustment dial. Now, that was related to the purposes set forth in the patent and in the prosecution file history of being attractive, of being safe, contributing to the safety angle, as it was called, and of being compact. And that was another aspect that their engineer testified to, is that it's a
compactness. I think I understand. What's the safety rationale? Aesthetics is not a ground on which you get a utility patent as opposed to a design patent. We must be talking size, and so what's the safety function of?
Safety is the fact that it has a greater radius and less likely to present an edge on which an occupant may hit themselves or somehow injure themselves by bumping into it or something to that effect. So that's the safety component. Attractiveness is still related to this visual dissonance that someone may pick up because it's out of alignment on the wall. And so there's still a utility aspect of that, even in utility patent sense, from the round versus rectangular type of arrangement. As said, the court also heard evidence regarding the replacement market. Honeywell has sold 85 million of these, and there is a use in that.
Do we know whether there are any data on safety? Is there an awful lot of both round and rectangular box-shaped thermostats in the world? Did CPSC collect any data on injuries inflicted by thermostats?
There's none in the record, so we do not know a specific extent that there may be injuries arising from that. It was specifically stated as a purpose in Honeywell's patent, and the engineer at trial testified that that was certainly still present in a greater radius. These 85 million thermostats provide a very broad base for a replacement market. When these thermostats are taken off the wall, however how they've been painted around or had wallpaper around them, people would like to just put something back that fits that hole. I'm sure you can put something over it that's bigger than it, but people would like to just how it was before. And this is, again, a preference. Now, Honeywell suffers from the problem that this court talked about in W.T. Rogers. They're a victim of their own success. At the tail end of that decision, the court said, you can be so successful that somebody wants your product feature that was identifying the source of a product for that particular feature. And once it has become intrinsic like that, then the only thing that will console you is your success, because you've lost the right or the ability to use it as an identifier in the marketplace. Honeywell's 85 million copies, forming a base for a replacement market out there, was good justification for the court to find its decision that it is still functional, still has utilitarian value. We also note that the court relied upon what Honeywell has done in this particular market. Honeywell tried to make something of the fact that it costs more to make round thermostats than it does to make rectangular thermostats. But the difference in cost between its rectangular T834 and its round T87 is only 35 cents. Yet Exhibit 57 shows in 1957 that there was an $11 or $12 premium between those two thermostats. So Honeywell was leveraging the fact that customers, a certain customer base, prefers that round shape and is willing to pay a premium to get that round shape. And the court heard that as testimony and evidence of present-day functionality. Honeywell also talked about congressional intent. In their brief, again at footnote 7, you will see excerpt from the legislative history where it is said that one of the intentions that Congress had in adding 33B8, that is the defense of functionality, to the statute, was for the purpose of rectifying or allowing courts to rectify the trademark register, because it noted that a growing number of product configurations had been issued that probably should not have issued. And the district court found ample evidence in the record that not only did the TTAB not apply the correct law or law that would be consistent with Supreme Court precedent of today, particularly Traffic and Daystar, but also that the TTAB had before it a materially false record and so was improperly swayed by that factual evidence. This is exactly the type of registration and exactly the type of problem that Congress wanted to address with this statute. And by making it available on or after the enactment date for cases that were filed thereafter, the Congress was not making it a retroactive legislation. Consequently, it is available in this case. But even if this court were to find that functionality is not available under 33B8, it would still be available in this case today. And the reason for that, I think, is at least two more. One is that to present an incontestable registration into evidence, it has to meet the conditions of incontestability in Section 15. Section 15 is not merely say if you file the affidavit that you automatically have an incontestable registration. One condition is that it must not be generic. And functionality is akin to genericness for product configurations. Genericness means that an identifier can no longer serve as a trademark. When a trademark is functional or becomes functional or is functional from the beginning, it cannot serve as a trademark. So Honeywell could put their incontestable registration into evidence, and then ECO could contest that as not meeting the conditions for incontestability under Section 15. Consequently, ECO could do it there. There is a third way that ECO could present the functionality defense in this particular case, and that is in the abuse of discretion, or looking at it under the abuse of discretion, that the analysis that the court must do to award a preliminary injunction. Now, what the court did in this particular case was say, what's the likelihood of success for Honeywell? Well, zero is about what he put it at. Now, if there were for some reason an incontestable registration that couldn't be taken head on by 33B8 functionality, then perhaps Honeywell's likelihood of success rises. And now then you weigh some harm Honeywell has with its likelihood of success based on the functionality defense not being available. And you look at the likelihood of success that ECO might win and the harm that's granted to them. But there's a third component in that weighing, that sliding scale. And that third component is the public's interest. And the public has had a right to copy this round base and circular convex shaped cover since February 12, 1963. And what Honeywell has been able to do and what the district court found is that through a design patent, common law trademark rights, a federal registration granted on a materially false record, and an incontestable registration, that it has extended the life of its patent. And that the right that the public had in being able to copy that thermostat configuration and use that type of housing began on February 12, 1963. And when you take that right that the public has and weigh it in that balance, it still comes out that ECO, as a member of the public, should be allowed to make thermostats that have a round base and a circular convex shaped cover. Honeywell also mentioned in its arguments that it had a settled expectation. That could hardly be true the way they have painted it. When they obtained an incontestable registration in 1995, Section 33B had already been amended once before. That was in 1988, and it added the defense of the equitable defenses to that list in 33B of the statute. And so Honeywell took their registration in 1995, or the incontestable status of that registration in 1995, knowing full well that the statute could be amended again. So they didn't have a settled expectation that there could not be an amendment to the statute. Secondly, they didn't have a very strong settled
expectation. I don't see how anybody could ever have a settled expectation that there won't be amendments to statutes.
Absolutely.
And a permanent prorogue of the legislature?
Exactly, and that's what
the Cato Institute would be happy.
I believe the United States Supreme Court noted that you can't unsettle some expectations, or that every legislation, every judicial system or decision has some effect in, it looks like footnote 22 or 24 in the Landgraf decision. This court, and we cited in our briefs Judge Niemeyer in the Shakespeare case in his dissent, that trademarks are not considered property, and so it is not a property issue. This court, we didn't cite it in our briefs, but this court...
I don't understand that argument at all. If somebody steals your trademark, they've stolen property. If somebody removes your trademark without due process of law, they could violate the due process clause, and that depends on the trademark being property. Rights under statutes are property. That's the new property ever since the early 70s, statutory rights equal property rights.
Well, this court in Libman versus Vining and in Dore Oliver versus Fluid Quip says that it is not property as much as it is an identifier. And I think why the court says that is because it has
a particular attribute. It can't be sold in gross. Right, you can sell Blackacre, but you can't sell the trademark in gross, and so on. But that's just attributes of the trademark. It doesn't mean it's not property. You're not saying, I trust, that the PTO could cancel a trademark without affording notice and an opportunity for a hearing to the trademark proprietor.
No, sir, I'm not.
But that depends on the trademark being property.
Well, there are certain property aspects. It's a mixed bag. I agree. But this court has said that it is an identifier, and I think the reason is that there's a public interest involved as well, because the function of trademarks is not only to be not only to protect the goodwill of a company that's invested in it, but also the public's ability to be able to distinguish goods based upon source identifiers, and that dual interest is what makes it difficult to classify.
Giving your three strongest points on functionality.
Three strongest points on functionality. That the patent clearly shows that a round base and circular convex shape cover are compact, attractive, and safe.
It's not more compact than a rectangular one, right? I mean, we're talking not even inches, right? You can make a rectangular one close to the side.
No, it is more compact in the sense that if I have a circle of diameter D,
right,
and I have a rectangle of D by Y,
right,
that has a larger area.
I understand the surface area, but I mean, it's not a dramatic reduction in size, is it, in the placement on a wall?
Well, being compact is important because it's not only the accuracy.
It's less visually offensive?
Yes, sir. Less visually offensive, and also it looks more compact to the eye because it's not presenting as large an area.
Do you think in the new digital instrumentation world that that's going to remain a big issue on function?
I have no way of knowing, sir.
I mean, it's going to be pretty hard to make it digital, aren't you, in that compact round size? I don't know.
I would think not. I would think if it's digital, usually makes things the components smaller, and so a round thermostat would probably be more desirable. And that feature is important for thermostat manufacturers to be able to have. So the patent and the purposes set forth in it,
I think it is not clear whether large or small is desirable.
Right.
Small is less visible. But it also means that people over the age of 55 have greater trouble turning the dial.
And well, it may be that other features can be added to enhance that.
I can imagine. I can just imagine this thermostat for people with arthritis. This thermostat for people without arthritis.
And in fact, that's one of the reasons that Honeywell included in Claim 23 of the 920 patent the centrally mounted dial, because it was perceived as being ergonomically more efficient for being able to get your fingers on it and be able to turn it. So there's another advantage there as well.
Not over touch or falling in.
Excuse me?
Not over touch or falling in, right?
You,
I don't want to bang anything outside the record, but someone's trying to sell me a thermostat where I just phone.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Another important point, I think, that in this record that shows functionality is the difference, the $11 premium in the marketplace. It shows that there is a feature in this thermostat that the public wants, and it desires to have it and is willing to pay a premium for it. And Honeywell is the only one who makes that round thermostat and has been able to leverage that desire for that feature to get this premium. And the only thing the public has got...
It's not clear which way that cuts. Maybe what that shows is that the public trusts Honeywell as the producer of these kinds of instruments. And it shows that your client is trying to take a free ride on Honeywell's goodwill.
I don't think so, sir. I think what it shows...
It doesn't necessarily show that. It's just that the premium for a trademark may reflect the public belief in the quality of the vendor. That is, the real, genuine trademark attribute. And so to point to the premium may point to its value as a trademark, not anything else.
I don't think so in this particular case, because the Honeywell T834 has the same trademark on it, and according to the testimony...
No, it doesn't have the same trademark on it. It's not the round thermostat. When you look at a round thermostat, you know it's a Honeywell. Now, your client wants to change that, I understand. When you look at a box on the wall, you have no idea who it's from. You can examine it closely.
May I answer the question?
Sure, of course.
Well, I think that what happens, well, there's testimony in the record that the components and the quality is the same. Honeywell is on both of them. What the public really wants...
Good trademark rights in one and not in the other.
Well,
so the public identifies one with Honeywell and doesn't identify the other with Honeywell. And it likes Honeywell products. Right? I'm not saying that that's the right way to understand what's going on, but it is a way to understand what's going on. That's why the price differential is an ambiguous indicator.
My time's up.
You may make a summary comment if you wish.
All right. We think that the judge had plenty of evidence before him, both past and present, as to the functionality of this round base and circular convex shaped cover. And the statute permitted this defense, and that he should be affirmed in denying the preliminary injunction.
All right, thanks, Bob. I'm sorry, my time has expired, but I gave a little less time. You may have a minute to make any further comment.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. If I could just point out one quick thing. This is a little bit of a whiplash oral argument, because the crux, I think, of Mr. Lockman's position is that the district court actually addressed utilitarian functionality of the round shape today. That is not correct, Your Honor. I would just refer you to pages 30 to 32 of the judge's opinion, where he says evidence of functionality. And on page 30, he says subsection A, utilitarian functionality. That is entirely based on the 1946 utility patent. The district court never considered any evidence of current utilitarian functionality, nor did Mr. Lockman in his brief take the position that he took today, that there's evidence of current utilitarian functionality. The only evidence that he referred to in his brief, and the only evidence regarding 2003, was evidence regarding aesthetic functionality.
What about the testimony of the Honeywell engineer?
We think that cuts our way, Your Honor. We think that's clear, and we in fact cite that as that is our affirmative evidence that it is not. That in fact thermostats today come much more compact. They come just as safe. They come with very rounded edges. They're closer to the wall. So the evidence that he was referring to is actually our evidence, and we completely stand by that evidence. It's uncontroverted that the 1946 utility aspects that Mr. Lockman referred to can be served equally well today by any other shape of thermostat.
Do you know whether there are any data that the Consumer Product Safety Commission keeps on the safety of thermostats?
I'm not aware, Your Honor, certainly of a rash of thermostat-related injuries. I think that would... It seems rather far-fetched, I must say, today.
Well, don't say that. I was able to find from the CPSC website that the CPSC has ordered two Honeywell thermostats to be recalled. So there are obviously some safety risks with thermostats, but unfortunately judicial paranoia has prevented me from searching their full database. The judiciary has a firewall, and you can't search the CPSC database from behind a firewall. So I just wondered if you knew the answer to what I was trying to say.
I don't know that offhand, Your Honor. It's not in the record. Again, I just think the only point is that the attempt to portray roundness as having a safety-related design that is makes it markedly different from other shaped thermostats today is not correct, and it's not what the district court decided below. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks, Your Honor. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.